Hello and welcome to the fifth podcast of the Summer Library. I am Paul Sorrell.
T.R. Parker. T.R., what's going on, man?
We're really excited. I can't believe this is our fifth podcast episode. It's not summer yet, but it's summer to me because most of the students are gone and we're hanging out.
It feels like summer.
Yeah, it does. It's getting hot, although it's been a little bit cooler in the mornings lately and in the evenings.
Right.
I'm going to try not to complain about the weather. I'm from Florida, so I should be able to handle it.
Absolutely.
Or lived in Florida for a long time. We've got a really exciting guest on the show today. We're really excited to...
Daryl Worley, right?
Twirly, as I like to call him on the basketball court.
Okay.
So it's not... That's his N1 name.
So it's not Daryl Worley, the country star?
No,
it's somebody even better.
No, Professor Taylor Worley, actually.
Who is the assistant professor of Christian thought and tradition.
Okay, yes.
And... There's more.
Yeah, there's even more.
He's
yeah.
also the Associate Dean for Spiritual Life and Campus yeah. Ministries.
You know you're important when your title is like a paragraph.
Yes.
You know? So we are really excited and honored to have Professor Taylor Worley with us on the program today. And we're going to talk to him a little bit about a lot of things and about his research and background and education and teaching. We're really excited to do that. One of the things I want to tell you about really quickly is that we have some new resources, some new databases in the library that I think will come in handy. I think they'll help Professor Worley and others with research. One of those things that we have is Oxford Bibliographies Online.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a mouthful.
Yeah. Oxford Bibliographies Online. The other day...
And what is that?
Well, it's Oxford Press has provided... It's basically bibliographies.
Mm-hmm.
We have that available in four subject areas, four large category subject areas, and there are subdivisions and particular topical bibliographies that you can search. So essentially, it is all of the best research and the best books and articles and sources on a particular topic. And the four areas that we have purchased are biblical studies, classics, medieval studies, and philosophy. So we think that will definitely help Professor Worley. The other day I was presenting in Professor Green's course on using library resources to research theology and biblical studies and whatnot. And he asked me if there was a sort of a place for best books. You know, traditionally in a print environment, you always had things come out that were best resources on a particular topic. And in the digital environment, things have exploded so rapidly, and there's so much more scholarship out there and publications out there that Oxford Bibliographies Online is going to be helpful in just discerning where should I start my research.
Right.
What's neat about it is if you find a particular bibliography that might help you start your paper, it'll also link to that in World Catalog, WorldCat, which is a resource that librarians use a lot to find where something is in a library and read a little bit more about it. We'll also link to a Google Books preview of the item so you can read an abstract, read about the authors. Sometimes Google Books even has full text of particular things.
They do.
WorldCat will tell you if we have it at Union's Library.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't have it, maybe we can order it for the collection or either order it for you interlibrary loan. So I think Oxford Bibliographies is going to be really helpful. So we're excited to add that. And we'll talk more about it as people come back in the fall.
Mm-hmm. What else is new?
Yeah. We have a database called Films for Humanities. It's a database of digital films. You can stream movies
wow.
on your computer.
what kind of movies?
Yeah, they're not always the most exciting movies. Like it's not going to be like the latest with Super 8 or X-Men or all the kind of summer blockbusters that are coming out now. Tree of Life isn't on there just yet. But it's provided by Films Media Group. Cambridge is one of the providers. Films for the Humanities and Sciences are another one of the providers. And that provides, there are a lot of like biographies and documentaries on authors on particular topics in history or church history or theology. There are also some very vocationally oriented things. Meridian Education Corporation provides career and technical education videos, and there are even like shopware kind of how-to films on there. So it provides a lot of content. You can go in and search. You can browse by subject. And it, so it's a pretty interesting BBC and A&E has some content that's been digitized on there. So it's a pretty neat resource for using films in the classroom or even if you're just bored on a Friday night and you want to check out Films for Humanities.
But not in class. You wouldn't want to, you know, pull that up if you were bored in class and watch that.
Not unless it was like part of the and that's
it. We would discourage that, right?
Yeah, pay attention to your professor.
Right. Now, will this be something that students and patrons of the library can stream from off campus, or is it just an on campus thing?
No, it's streamable from off campus. Everything that most of the databases that we provide are. Available off campus as well. If you go to the library homepage and click on databases A to Z, you'll find it listed. And you can just log in with the same login that you use to check your email.
Yeah.
And you should be able to log in. If you're on campus, you won't need to log in. It'll know that we're on campus by looking at our IP address.
Right.
And it'll take you right into the database. So it's pretty neat. Dr. Worley, on the note of like, you know, streaming. Yes.
Well, we will be back with our interview with Professor Taylor Worley after.
Okay. We'll be right back. Sorry.
We're back. Thanks for sticking with us. And we are about to bring to you one of the most popular professors on campus, and that would be Taylor Worley. Again, Taylor is the Assistant Professor of Christian Thought and Tradition and Associate Dean of Spiritual Life Campus Ministries, which is at what, two business cards?
Yeah, it kind of folds down. It just drops down and down and down, you know, kind of
very
like
nice, like an accordion.
Yeah, sort of like that. You know.
Very nice. Very nice. So I know that there are a lot of things that we're going to cover today. TR, do you want to get us going?
On the note of we were talking about Films for Humanities. Now you're interested in film, is that right, Professor?
Yeah. I actually offer an opportunity to watch film in class.
Really?
So yeah, you don't have to pull it up on your laptop and sneak it. You can actually take a class in which you get to watch some film for class. So the course I'm talking about, which I'm excited about the Films for Humanities database, I think it's going to be really helpful for research for my students. This is one of those courses that I'm just sort of amazed that, you know, I get kind of paid to teach this course. It's called Philosophy of Film. It's a course that Greg Thornberry actually designed and handed off to me a few years ago. But it's a course in which we look at the intersection of film and philosophy. And so there are obviously ways in which you can read a film philosophically. I mean, everybody's seen The Matrix and thought about ways in which, you know, different philosophical ideas or concepts are illustrated in that film. And then there's other films that kind of try and do philosophy. And that's kind of what we're more interested in. So movies that are kind of asking questions that maybe even philosophers haven't yet asked in a text or in a kind of dialogue or academic setting. So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And you get to watch movies. So
yeah. So now I've been to one of your classes actually, and you need to focus on the lecture, and it was really engaging. What would be your policy if someone were to have a laptop in class and be doing something? I mean, do you allow laptops in the digital age, do you?
Yeah. I mean, obviously a lot of students are going to be using laptops, you know, pretty extensively. I try and avoid laptop use in sort of the freshman sophomore courses, just so there's an environment created in which there's more opportunity to focus in on the lecture or the class interaction. But obviously, like in kind of upper level courses, you know, it's just more convenient for students to use their laptops in class. So I don't have a problem with it. And at that point, you know, it's really up to them to bring the level of engagement and attention that they want to bring. So
what type of movies do you show in your class?
Yeah. So what we look for, I've taught the course two times now, and the first time that I taught it was kind of pairing a kind of philosophically enriching film with a text from a modern or postmodern philosopher. And that, I think, created, to kind of reference Alfred Hitchcock here, some vertigo in the room. So changing films and filmmakers and philosophers every week was a bit dizzying for the students. So this past semester, I taught the course again, and I kind of stuck with three filmmakers and three philosophers. And so people would get a, you know, could kind of get the lay of the land for the first week or two, and still have another week or so to kind of engage with that philosopher and that filmmaker. So we did three filmmakers and three philosophers. So I'll give you those. So the first filmmaker we looked at was Ingmar Bergman, Swedish filmmaker, very famous, very influential on people like Woody Allen. And we paired the three of his films with three readings from Soren Kierkegaard, so one of the kind of fathers of existentialism. And, you know, big influence. A lot of Bergman's films are kind of haunted by the ghosts of Kierkegaard. The next installment of the course was three Alfred Hitchcock films, which you can never go wrong with Hitchcock, I feel like. It's kind of funny at this point. We talked a lot about in the course, students have maybe seen some Hitchcock on, you know, kind of cable movie channels. Right. You know, it's sort of like a mom and dad or grandparents kind of, you know, that might have been cool back then, or suspenseful. But there's actually a lot going on, especially with the psychology of Hitchcock's movies. And you know, we actually have in the library quite a few resources on Hitchcock and philosophy. So that's been really helpful, you know, to kind of point students toward. So there's a lot of discussion about how he used philosophy, and in particular kind of the psychology that he created. So we paired those films with a contemporary philosopher who would take a lot of time to unpack, but he's a Slovenian philosopher named Slavoj Žižek. So it looks a lot better spelled out than pronounced. I'm probably, you know, messing up the Slovenian pronunciation. But the third installment, which was hopefully a preparation for a movie that just came out a few weeks ago, was three films from Terrence Malick, who's done Badlands and Days of Heaven, Thin Red Line, The New World, and his movie The Tree of Life just came out a couple weeks ago. It won the Palme d'Or at Cannes, the Cannes Film Festival.
And I understand that you actually just saw that film.
I have to give credit where credit's due. TR made it possible for me to see The Tree of Life. It's only opened in select theaters so far. So it had an opening in New York and L.A. And then the next spot was Chicago. So that coincided really nicely with TR's trip to the ATLA conference in Chicago. So I got to see that long before a lot of my friends, and so a lot of them kind of angry at me and not returning my text messages or calls right now. But we looked at those films, and I feel like even after seeing The Tree of Life, a filmmaker like Terrence Malick, it requires a kind of reflective and kind of thoughtful approach, and having kind of the background in philosophy can be really helpful. So he was actually a student at Harvard and studied in the philosophy department there, and then went on to Oxford and started a PhD, or actually at Oxford it's called a DPhil, on kind of modern philosophy and existentialism in particular. And he quit that to become a filmmaker. So he's a real student of Martin Heidegger, who's another one of the kind of pioneers of continental philosophy and existentialism in particular. So having that background, I think, really helped prepare me for the film, which if you do get a chance to see it, and I hope you do, it's a real experience. About 30 minutes into the film, people were getting up and walking out, and I had a couple folks next to me that were asking questions throughout the film and kind of complaining about maybe how artsy it was, right. But I really enjoyed it. So, and it was really impactful for me.
So, when did you become interested in films more so than just, oh, let's go to the movies, what's playing this weekend?
Yeah.
When did film start meaning yeah. something to you on a deeper level?
Yeah. Well, it all goes back to my days as a student at Union. Mm-hmm. I graduated in 2001, and I guess the best way to describe it is I was kind of ruined in terms of having that kind of uncritical or unthoughtful approach to just film as entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
So even movies that obviously are made just for entertainment's sake, it's kind of hard to watch them anymore without a kind of critical lens asking bigger questions like, well, what does this say about the nature of society, or
right.
or what's a good life all about?
And do you
simple
think
questions
that
like that
filmmakers are purposely putting things in their films, or is it just, oh, let's see if we can make a buck on this? And
yeah.
or do you, I mean, do they have a cerebral approach to movies, or is it something that seems to be deconstructed afterwards? And you know, well, the filmmaker probably meant this, and you're going,
yeah.
you know, the filmmaker couldn't care less about
oh, yeah.
whatever. It's just a way to make money. I mean, I'm sure there are some films mm-hmm. that there's a lot of thought going into it, a lot of symbolism, a lot of approach that, mm-hmm. you know, is on a deeper level.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's kind of surfaced often in the course, actually, and kind of interacting with students and getting interested in film, because there are a lot of films out there that don't really deserve our attention or don't really deserve further analysis. Mm-hmm. And some things you just sort of see and, you know, maybe you wish you didn't see.
Right.
Or maybe you just forget about it and just kind of go on about your life, and it doesn't make a dent. And
right.
you were entertained for a couple hours there, and
I guess
nice
that serves
experience.
A purpose.
Yeah, I mean that's okay. You know, that's yeah. okay. I mean, I think the origins of film of going to the movies, the Nickelodeons back in the day, obviously Charlie Chaplin, and kind of the early pioneers in American film had that at the forefront. But I think if you go back and watch someone that is as much a kind of creative genius as Chaplin,
mm-hmm.
you'll see, and actually had a student, Abby Evansberger, did a fantastic paper on Charlie Chaplin.
And incidentally, yeah. I met with Abby
yeah.
for to help her get started with the research, and it inspired me to do a display. So we had a display on Charlie mm-hmm. Chaplin yeah. resources in the library for most of the semester.
Mm-hmm.
So that was neat.
Yeah, so someone like Chaplin can do really provocative and thoughtful comedy. So if
right.
you take a film like Modern Times, on the surface, it's just fun to
mm-hmm.
watch. I mean, that's... You know, I think the Marx Brothers are like this too. I saw Duck Soup, you know, a couple of years ago for the first time, and just was amazed by it. You know,
mm-hmm.
I thought I just loved every minute of it. It was so fun to watch. But thinking about the context
yeah.
And who the kind of identity issues of who the Marx Brothers were, and this is the same for Chaplin, obviously, with a film like The Great Dictator. There's lots of other issues that can't help but be brought into the conversation as you think about that film more deeply. And so I think there are a lot of films that don't deserve our attention, but there is a class of film that can't be sort of summarized by a critic's review, can't be kind of dismissed by a Rotten Tomatoes
right.
Ranking or something like that, you know,
mm-hmm.
that can actually push the imagination forward.
Sure.
And so there's even philosophers that have talked about how kind of, especially in a digital age and in an age of in a kind of video age, people like Jean Baudrillard and others have talked about, you know, we kind of think visually now, you know, our imaginations are really motivated by what we see. And, you know, Jean Baudrillard got in a lot of trouble for saying that the first Gulf War was a war that happened on television,
mm-hmm.
right? Because it in the imaginations of people in the West, it was just a news story,
right?
It didn't kind of impact them, and this was his claim. So
there was a song recently that I heard that described it as a televised war.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Conroe
yeah.
Burst thing.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah. But.
So in preparing for a career as a professor and with films. What were some of the things that you studied while you were a student here at Union?
Yeah. Well, I think it does go back to my experience at Union and kind of the mentorship of Greg Thornberry in particular, but just the environment that was created here early on in the David Dockery era, in which there was a space made for kind of critical thinking and engaging with culture, not being kind of afraid or retreating to some easy fundamentalisms about culture. So it wasn't uncommon to watch a movie in a professor's home, or to go to the movies with any one of my professors and kind of talk about it afterwards. And just being introduced to how that could be done, that could actually be a thing, to have these kind of reflective conversations about, well, what do you think, you know, this meant, or what do you think the filmmaker might be trying to suggest by this artistic choice in the film? It just created a space for me to kind of ask those questions, and that set kind of a trajectory for me in kind of my professional career, I guess you could say. I mean, I've always I've been fortunate to kind of study things that I'm passionate about and things that I'm interested in. Mm-hmm. Now I have the opportunity to teach students about it. It's kind of, I'm pinching myself that this is actually a reality now.
Right.
You know, it was a dream for many years.
Right. And you get to, extend what you've learned and you know, Union's changed a lot even in the 10 years since you graduated. So you get to move that along and even more in depth with film study and things like that.
Oh, yeah. I'm aware of being a part of a larger legacy, you know. So I'd always said, you know, if the opportunities present themselves, I can go on and do further study and maybe do research and a PhD. I'd love to teach at a place like Union. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd love to be in like kind of an aspiration school that is trying to get to where Union was when I was a student. You know, right. I never dreamed that I'd get to be a part of the legacy and kind of play a role in even pushing that legacy forward. So yeah, that's my hope. You know, I think there's a lot of great and hopeful and encouraging signs that legacy is moving forward and taking even greater leaps and bounds than it did when I was a student. Mm-hmm. So
now, Taylor, going back to your undergraduate years, you mentioned that you graduated in 2001. Mm-hmm. What was your actual major?
Yeah.
And at what point did you start to think that maybe graduate school is for me? I know that a lot of our students think about that. And so, what was that? What were those years like?
I transferred to Union. In 1998, and I had thought I was going to pursue architecture at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. And so that interest in kind of art and design and architecture is kind of lingered, kind of stayed in the background for a little while. But I came to Union looking for the opportunity to explore what was a call on my life to the gospel ministry. And I'd kind of ran for that for a while because I thought it meant something very, very narrow, like either this path or that path. And neither of those, you know, seemed attractive to me. So, I was really encouraged to find once I got to Union that God can put a call on someone's life and it can manifest itself in different ways in different seasons. And so that was exciting. So it kind of opened up a lot of doors for me to explore, well, what am I interested in? What am I curious about? So I ended up doing a Bachelor of Arts in Christian Studies, which meant that I was able to sort of get a foundation in all the essential disciplines for theology and biblical studies. But I was able to then kind of explore lots of different avenues. So cultural engagement, ethics, theology, church history. I could get to explore these areas more in depth as a kind of buffet style, kind of pick and mix. I had lots of room for electives, and then I was an English minor actually, which was a lot of fun. So I kind of double dipped my humanities chip for sure, and took some English courses that were I think just as impactful on me as a theologian, as a as a philosopher, as some of my Christian studies courses, because they were kind of taught from the perspective of the Christian intellectual tradition and the Christian worldview. So,
So what are your some of your favorite things to read in terms of like being an English minor and do you have some things?
Yeah,
that you,
I'm
you kind know, of.
I mean, I feel like I'm always trying to kind of go back and repair my understanding, my experience of the classics. So I'm interested in contemporary authors for sure, and I'm trying to catch up, but still going back and reading the classics. So, you know, obviously there's a strong pull toward people like Flannery O'Connor and Wendell Berry, folks that are kind of working in the
Southern environment.
Yeah, the Southern environment. Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of that Southern imagination.
Sure. Walker Percy.
Which is a weird thing in and of itself.
The Moviegoer is one of my favorite novels. Yeah. Okay, so I have to ask this. Now, this was 1998 to 2001.
Yeah.
This was before it was Professor Worley, and it was just Taylor, and I can imagine he was a fun guy to be around. But so this was before Barefoots. This was before the Bold Student Commons.
Mm.
Before Jennings, even?
Jennings was like 2000.
Okay. Wow. So different campus. Mm. Where did you study?
Yeah.
Did you use the library? I mean, you don't have to say yes, you know.
No. I'd be glad to talk about that. There weren't a lot of places to go. Fortunately, my living situation was what I thought was – at the time I thought was wonderful. I mean, I had a room on a suite to myself, which was great. I had lived in a large dormitory in Knoxville that did not have air conditioning. Mm. And I lived in a room about the size of this room, one bed on this side of the room, one bed on that side of the room. So I was kind of in the promised land with respect to the living arrangement. But what had happened when I was in Knoxville was I was actually forced to spend a lot of time in their library. And I would kind of go and set up, and there was lots of room, and it was a good environment. Just kind of typical large university library. But I'd kind of cultivated some habits of kind of going there and spending time and working on stuff. So when I came to Union, it was I didn't need to be attracted to the library here. So I did spend a lot of time in the library here on campus. And a lot of people did at the time. Unfortunately so, I think it kind of remains this in some ways. It was a kind of socialization hub. You met a lot of people, and the study rooms were, very coveted if you could get them.
You could get one.
Yeah. If you could get one, they were nice. But
VIP
access. But a carrel or a table was fine. But I think it's funny. My wife likes to tell the story that our first meeting happened in the library.
Yes. You heard it here.
I don't think you knew this.
Taylor met Anna in the library.
Now, she likes to say that was sort of emblematic of the next 10 years of our life and the kind of the trajectory I would take her on with grad school and seminary and all the rest.
It all starts in the library.
It did in our case. Yeah, it did
great.
In our case. I was trying to study and she was making friends. We hadn't met before, and we were introduced there. So it all started there. And
yeah,
we ended up reading the same book, not together, but kind of were able to talk about it not long after that. And yeah, so the library did kind of play a role in our.
That's what we want to be known for.
That's what it is. Yeah,
forget eHarmony.
Well, just come to the library. It's where it's happening. Where I worked before, they actually would refer to the, because it was such a busy spot, they would actually refer to the library as Club Olin, because it was open until 1 and people were there, and it was. But I read a lot of articles about the academic environment on small college campuses. And there's this one article that I really love called Making College a Great Place to Talk. And it talks about the academic health of a university or a college being one of the major indicators is not test scores or rankings, but how dynamic, how vital, how intellectual is the conversation. And so I really believe that libraries don't have to be just like a warehouse for books, to quote President Dockery, but also can be an intellectual center, an intellectual hub for interaction and even social interaction, dare I say. So
I was kind of surprised even then that there wasn't a more militant approach to noise and
so you never were shushed?
No, I don't think so. I think it was a pretty – I mean on the whole it was a pretty hospitable environment. So yeah, I really appreciated that.
Yeah. So. Well, so 2001, you graduated from Union. What came next?
Yeah. Well, right after that, Anna and I got married, and we moved to Louisville, Kentucky, and we started seminary. And so that was the next, like, 4 to 5 years of our lives we spent in Louisville, which is a great city. And there's some good libraries there. There's a great art library on the U of L, the University of Louisville campus that I've used.
They have since. It's just an art library. It's
just an art library.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So the art books, the works of art.
Very aggressive collections development. Policy.
Do they have a program? Do they have a big program in art? Or
There's a large art major there.
Oh,
I think.
Wow, that's great. That's
I think the library actually outpaces even the art department because we knew some students there that were art majors. But it's the best collection of art resources I've found in the Southeast. Really,
wow. Well, that sounds like a great road trip. Louisville.
After Southern Seminary, you went to England?
Yeah. We moved to England. I started a PhD at the University of Durham in Durham, England, which is in northern England, very close to the larger city, Newcastle, not far from the border with Scotland.
How was that? Was that a culture shock?
It was a bit. It was a bit. We lived mainly with other international students. Mm-hmm. So for the first year that we lived there, we got a lot more flavor of kind of international culture than we did necessarily British culture. There were only a couple folks in our building. It was mainly couples and families that spoke English as their first language. Mm-hmm. So our good friends from the first year were a Norwegian couple and an Italian couple. So, but yeah, it was interesting. I was kind of challenged because their library there in Durham I guess they're still in the process of some serious updating. So actually, one day I was kind of in the library. What I would do is there wasn't dedicated study space necessarily. You couldn't reserve a carrel. Even PhD students couldn't reserve a carrel there, which I thought was kind of strange. I was sort of looking forward to that. And my department, the Department of Theology and Religion, at the time didn't have a dedicated space for their postgrads. So what it meant was a lot of bicycle trips with backpacks full of books down to the library and back to our apartment. So that meant I didn't spend a lot of time at their library. I would just sort of go and kind of collect things and just make periodic trips once or twice a week, something like that. But one time I was in the library and actually got the chance to sort of participate in a survey that the architects there were kind of looking at how they could renovate or update the space. Mm-hmm. So,
now, how did you become familiar with this school? Is this something that someone told you about? You just happened to find out about?
At the juncture where you're looking to do PhD work, I mean, I try and encourage folks that ask me about it. At least, I mean, from my limited experience, you're more looking for a specific faculty member that you want to study under, especially in the British system, where there's no coursework, there's voluntary participation in research seminars, but on the whole, it's just independent work with your doctoral supervisor. So it's kind of all make or break coming down to that relationship. So you want to really choose the relationship and not necessarily the school. So I didn't know much about the School of Durham, but I did get to know the supervisor that I would be under, whose name is David Brown. He's a fellow of the British Academy, a very respected philosophical theologian and ordained priest in the Anglican Church. I can say lots about him. But he was the most positive about the kind of work that I was interested in doing. So I thought, well, that's where I go. You know, I go work with this guy. So it really just came down to my relationship with him.
And at that point, coming out of Southern, what were your specific interests? I mean, what was it specifically that drew you to him? I mean, you had at that point developed some very specific interest.
Yeah. I mean, I left Union with lots of different interests. I mean, I knew that my talents and abilities were more in the kind of the area of theology and philosophy. It only took a couple of years in Dr. Jackson's Greek class to know that I wasn't going to be breaking any kind of archaeological or textual secrets in biblical studies. But what happened at the end of my time in seminary was a couple key faculty members there helped me see that there is this conversation emerging around theology and the arts. And so I got so that represented for me an opportunity to take some of my old interests in art and architecture and culture and sort of see that kind of come together in a more organic way with my abilities in theology and philosophy. So when I looked at Durham, David Brown had been doing this big series of work on theology and the arts and kind of a sacramental theology of the arts, looking at not just art forms that are used within the church, but also art forms out more broadly and outside of the church, and kind of asking religious questions about those. So he seemed like a great person to work with.
Yeah. Now, but you didn't. You actually went on from Durham to St. Andrews.
Yeah, it's kind of a long story. So in the summer of 2007, our daughter Elizabeth was born in the UK. Unfortunately, she's not a British citizen.
Yeah.
That would have been nice, but she does have a British birth certificate, so that's something, right? My wife was actually given the opportunity to take kind of a severance package from her job there in Durham, and we were able to transition back to the States, at which time we thought, okay, Taylor can ride up from back in the States. It's obviously less expensive to live back here than it is to live there. I could go part-time, so I'm paying part-time fees, and kind of start networking and looking for schools. Around that time, we just said it'd be good to be back in Jackson. It's close to our family. You know, there's a community around Union that we're still close with. It's just a good place to be. So we just sort of – that's where we threw our hats. What happened in the meantime was my supervisor was – David was given a new chair at the University of St. Andrews. So that meant that – as part of the deal for him moving there, he was able to take his students with him so they could finish with him. So I was just sort of accepted at the University of St. Andrews. So, I transferred in my undergrad and ended up transferring in my doctoral program. I thought never again, but yeah, it happened. And then the door opened. Obviously wanted to make myself available for any kind of work that I could do here in Jackson, and the door opened that they needed a couple courses, help with a couple courses in Christian studies, and I was in the right place at the right time. The Lord opened the door, and that was the beginning.
Now, quickly, we have to ask this with St. Andrews, and that's in Edinburgh, Scotland. What's the environment like there, and what was the library like at St. Andrews?
Yeah, they... What happened was we never actually lived in the village of St. Andrews. I would just make trips back there. So it meant I spent a lot of time in the library. So I'd be staying at a hotel or a hostel or something on my stay, have some important meetings, but most of the time I spent in the library. And they've got a great library there as well. It's probably the best in Scotland, even though I think University of Edinburgh might be a copyright library actually. But St. Andrews had great resources, but it was like the University of Durham's library in that it was badly in need of some updating.
Sure. Let me ask you this then, like when in between those times when you might be traveling or you just couldn't find space or study Carol, where do you like to spend time writing, researching, reading?
Oh yeah, I'm a fiend for the coffee shop.
Oh so yeah,
I spend a lot of time in that third place in the coffee shop.
Yeah,
So as long as I keep the coffee coming, I can get a lot done.
Yeah. Now, we mentioned the trip to Chicago. You were just recently in Chicago. You saw the Tree of Life, and you had some good coffee there too. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, Chicago has emerged, I guess, in the last few years as a real kind of pilgrimage site for great coffee, at least in this country. And one of the leading kind of coffee roasters in the country is Intelligentsia Coffee, which they have a free app in the App Store if you want to check it out.
You have to have a certain IQ to go in, right?
Yeah.
Fortunately,
I just got in because I was with him. Yeah. So.
Fortunately, it's not like bourgeoisie coffee or, something like that. But it's great coffee and it's done really well. I mean, every cup is custom made, so it's very nice. Yeah,
and then your wife Anna, who you met here at Union, she actually works in the coffee industry as well. Is that right?
Yeah. She works for Gusa Java here in Jackson, and kind of helps manage their operations. And so I was, had to do a little reconnaissance work while in Chicago, and kind of check out the Intelligentsia operation and give her some feedback.
And now there was a thing called a clover too. Right? Can you tell us about the clover?
Yeah. I did make a foray into the corporate world with the Starbucks. But and confession is good for the soul, I guess. Another great option, if you can't make it to one of the three Intelligentsia shops in Chicago, is to look for a Starbucks that has a clover machine. So the clover machine is an interesting – it's kind of a vacuum press, I guess, for coffee. So if you've had a French press coffee, it's very similar to that, but even nicer because there's not as much residue at the bottom of your cup. There would be a little bit, but not very much. It was actually built by – I mean, this is the legend that I've heard. It was actually built by students at MIT and sold – as a kind of custom coffee machine for like $15,000 or something. So there's a few places around the country that actually have them, but apparently Starbucks bought up the patent several years back and they're sort of doing them. So I got Intelligentsia in the morning and Clover made coffee in the afternoons, and made sure TR tried one as well. Yeah.
So. Now that made sure that kept you awake and alert and focused, so you were doing some research while you were there too, right? Can you want to briefly tell us about that?
Yeah. So everything kind of lined up really well for the Chicago trip. It was a lot of fun, obviously, but it was in large part a business trip for me, I guess you could say. I had the opportunity back in September of last year to help organize a conference. First opportunity to organize a conference. So I learned a lot on that. But with a colleague of mine who's also a student of our supervisor, who actually teaches at the University of Sewanee, the University of the South in outside of Chattanooga. So we organized a conference back in September in St. Andrews. So it was for our supervisor, and we invited a lot of papers, and there were some facilitators. And so what we did was we took all those papers and we've been editing them for a book that Oxford University Press is going to publish, I think later this year, or maybe out early next year. So
that's
I was working on editing those things while we're in Chicago.
That's great. We'll look forward to the publication of that and the purchase of it for the library. Now, you may know that we're really excited about getting a new library, and that might make us neighbors because, from what I've heard, the library is going to be over there next to Jennings Hall. Do you have any kind of your experience going to different academic institutions, doing a PhD in England, going to unions, traveling, seeing libraries in Louisville? Do you have any kind of thoughts on that or anything, maybe coffee? What are your kind of visions?
I think what would be great is if we could take the best of the culture that's already been created here and try and sort of migrate that to a new space, a more accommodating space, maybe a larger space that could host more opportunities for students to find connection on campus. So what I'm interested in is not just students sort of you know, coming to class, getting, you know, downloading some information from me, you know, I do actually point out to especially my freshmen a little thing called iTunes University that most of them don't know about. But
yeah,
you can get
this podcast is actually on iTunes University.
So, and lots of other schools are putting great courses, great series of lectures. I mean, some seminaries, you know, so there's an amazing plethora of information out there. It just requires the time to download it. So if a student is in my class just interested in downloading information, you know, they might be better served, I don't know, at back in their dorm room on iTunes, or maybe not even going to college at all. I'm really interested in asking the question, well, what does a 21st century classroom look like? And so I'm hoping that the interaction that happens within the classroom will spill over into other spaces,
yeah.
You know, spaces like Barefoot's Joe, the coffee shop here on campus, or the library, you know, places for students to connect around projects and not just to sort of get something done or just take care of their, you know, that's the place to take care of homework, but also make connections outside of the classroom. So maybe even like with the philosophy of film course, maybe even having a space where students could view a film before class. You know, that'd be helpful, you know.
Yeah, making college a great place to talk.
Yeah.
Okay, well, those all sound like really great things, and I think we could probably go on and talk forever. Now, there's one more thing I have to ask you about just briefly. The word on the street is that you are running a marathon. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I'm training with a group of friends that I go to church with for the St. Jude Marathon.
Oh, wow.
In December. So
it's exciting.
It's going to be great. Yeah. I've never done a full marathon before. I've done a few halves in the past and tried to train for a full, but I was training by myself, and so it didn't really work out. So I'm looking forward to training with a group of friends and seeing what happens.
Just like I think academia and learning is done better with a group of friends.
Oh, yeah.
Training also is done.
Yeah, we can always do more in community.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and so the library, I think, can be part of that academic community.
Oh, yeah.
So thank you so much for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you, Taylor. Now, just one last thing before we go. Any movie recommendations for the people who might be listening?
Yeah, definitely The Tree of Life. If you have any shot at seeing that, it's going to open June 24th in Memphis and in Nashville. And in Nashville, it's going to be at the Bell Court, which is a kind of art house theater that needs a lot of patronage. They could use some work. But it's also going to be in Memphis at City on the Square. That's going to be the highlight of the summer, I'm sure. I'm trying to think of other things that I'm really looking forward to. I mean, it's all sort of culminating with that. If it had come out early enough, I would have made that the final exam in my philosophy of film course to go see The Tree of Life, and they could have failed the class by not seeing it or something.
That's very good.
I can't do that.
Look forward to that. And Paul, you had a quick announcement about the library hours over the coming up in a few weeks.
Right, and we'll get to that after we come back. And just want to say thank you once again to Taylor and appreciate all the information you gave us. Very insightful and some of your background. And I know you've got a big year planned, and then your students have a lot to look forward to. So thanks again for joining
us
today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Thank you for being here.
All right, and we'll be right back after this short break. And we are back, and the day is June 14th, and that means that we have a holiday coming up not too far from here. And just want to let everyone know that the library will be closed for the Independence Day holiday, July 2nd through the 4th. The 4th is on Monday, so we will be closed that whole weekend.
Okay.
So July 2nd through 4th, the library will be celebrating independence.
Yeah. Be safe and have fun. Go visit family.
That's
enjoy
right.
Enjoy the sunshine.
Absolutely. Go see a ball game.
Yeah, baseball.
Eat a hot dog. Eat a $5.50 hot dog at the new Kaminsky Park. What is it now in Chicago?
It's actually U.S. Cellular Field, and we were just there last Friday night, and you can get a Chicago-style dog That's actually a little step up from the dogs they have at the Jackson Generals game, but it, you know,
it's a step up in price as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah.
So we wish everyone a happy and safe Independence Day.
Yeah, and don't forget the Emma Water Summers Library, or the Summer Library, as we like to call it, where studying every day could help you perform better academically.
All right, thanks for listening.